Hey, thank you for joining me this week. This A Dying to Live podcast is all about conversations on living, loving, and dying. You know, the reality of death and the importance of what it means to be alive are intimately weaved together by love. When asked what is the span of human life, the Buddha is said to have replied, the span of an in-breath and out-breath. And I found that to be true in my own personal life, and also in the work that I've done even as a hospice chaplain and before that a minister, that death sometimes can teach us so much about love. Love can teach us so much about death. And so that sets up my interview with a conversation I had with best-selling singer-songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman. In this interview you're going to hear, she talks about the death of her husband, about a song that she downloaded divinely, about what she was going through after his death, and so much more. It's really a story about love, which you'll really hear in a lot of her songs. You're going to hear not only an inspiring conversation, but I'll play three or four of her songs in this interview and in this time we have together as well. So I want to thank you again for joining me. And here is a conversation I've had with Beth. From writing hits for other artists to recording her own, twice Grammy-nominated Beth Nielsen Chapman, Nashville-based singer-songwriter, has truly embraced musical diversity. A breast cancer survivor, environmental activist, teacher of workshops, and lecturer on the magic of creativity, she's penned numerous hits and written songs for many top artists, including Bonnie Raitt, Emmylou Harris, Bette Midler, Elton John, Neil Diamond, Trisha Yearwood, Michael McDonald, Amy Grant, Keb Moe, Roberta Flack, Faith Hill, Willie Nelson, and so many other artists. Her music has been heard on TV shows ER, Dawson's Creek, Providence, Felicity, and in movie soundtracks including The Prince of Egypt, Message in a Bottle, The Rookie, Where the Heart Is, and Practical Magic. Mega hit This Kiss, sung by Faith Hill, was ASCAP's 1999 Song of the Year, garnered a Grammy nomination, and Nashville NAMI's 1999 Songwriter of the Year. Among Beth's own recordings, the groundbreaking song Sand and Water, released following the death of her husband from cancer in 1994, was performed by Elton John on his 1997 U.S. tour in place of Candle in the Wind. It's a joy to have Beth on the program because I've been such a fan of her music, and she joins us from her home in beautiful Nashville, Tennessee. Beth Nielsen Chapman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be talking to you, Richard.
It is such a joy to have you on. I have followed your music, and you know, then I realized that so many of the artists whose songs I so enjoyed were songs you wrote.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, that you got to hear them.
There's a lot that I want to talk about, but first, let's start kind of in the beginning for you. I believe you were 10 or 11. I think your dad, who's in the military, correct?
Yep, he's in the Air Force.
Yeah, and I believe it was in Germany when the story I read is your mom hit a guitar for Father's Day. You found it and started playing guitar. And I think it was that year where you started learning how to play guitar and piano.
It really, you know, we always had a little piano rented somewhere, you know, along the way as I was growing up. But I got really interested about the time I stole the guitar from my dad before Father's Day. I kind of showed it to him. I let him view it for a few seconds and said, oh, this will be in my room whenever you want to play it. So, but the timing couldn't have been better because I was just at that angsty age of 11, you know, starting to turn into a teenager and all of the hormones going crazy. And it was 1968, and that was really an age for me where I was kind of starting to watch the news and look at, you know, kind of look around out of my child, peek out of my childhood into the world. And I was stunned by the scariness of some stuff, you know, like I'd be watching the news on the Vietnam War and things. And we were stationed in Germany at the time. And really what dovetailed around that same time was that we went to one of the field trips that we had at our school, unbelievably, was to go to Dachau, and which is a concentration camp. And, I mean, I think a child of 11 or 12 just should not go there as a field trip. Honestly, I thought it was not a good idea.
It was very intense.
It was very intense, and it kind of shocked me. It was like, I don't know, weeks and weeks following that, I had really bad nightmares. And in the interim, my father got his orders, and we were to move and be restationed, which happened every couple of years. But at this particular time, and when I was feeling that vulnerable and overwhelmed, we got our orders to move to Montgomery, Alabama, and that was just terrifying to me because I was also up on the fact that, you know, they just shot Martin Luther King and all this other stuff,
yeah,
and the civil rights movement. And my mom was like, honey, you know, you need to chill out. I'm like, ah, you know. But it's amazing. The guitar and writing songs and writing poetry and, you know, hiding myself under the covers and being creative really saved me through that period of time and gave me a lifelong connection to creativity being the tool that helps me to heal and helps me through my life. And to this day, you know, it's been and continues to be that way.
Well, it has. And I want to talk about a few things like that here coming up. I'm only 2 years older than you. And so I remember what you're talking about. I remember the news where they had the casualties listed. I remember when I was a little boy hearing that Robert F. Kennedy got assassinated and I had tears down my face. I'm also wondering concerning music because of our similar age. Were you also, as I was, although I'm not a singer-songwriter, and my escape was nature, that's why I'm an environmentalist, were you influenced by James Taylor and Carole King and some of those people back then who were writing so many cool songs at that time?
Oh, yes. Oh, massively. I mean, you know, right around the time that we moved to Nashville, I mean, within a year, James Taylor was all over the airwaves.
Yeah.
And prior to that, I'd always been completely magnetically, you know, pulled towards songs, like songs that my parents' Tony Bennett albums and all the classic, you know, songs of the 30s and the 40s. And I was just always enamored with structure and the way a song pops and what about a song just like reaches into the heart of people. I mean, I remember noticing that really, really young age. And then when James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Carole King and all those guys came along, they were like my people. You know, that was like my real stepping into, this is my music. And and it had a huge influence on me, of course, and so many other people. And even, you know, even that I was still listening to jazz and Motown and R&B and all that all at the same time. We just got to grow up at a time when there was such a melting pot of creative influences that we were exposed to, you know. And nowadays you have to go to the channel that has this and go to the channel that has that. And it's easy to miss, I think, so much richness that, you know, that we were, you and I, you know, in the age that we grew up in, it was just all right there.
Yeah, yeah. And you were the middle child of five. Did your siblings also have a passion for music, or were you primarily the
one? Well, yeah, we all loved it. I mean, you know, we'd fight over who got to play the Beatles records and the Monkees records. I'm the only surviving professional musician that I know of, but my three sisters and my brother are all very, very creative. And, you know, one of the great gifts that we got from our parents was kind of a blank check to be creative. And, you know, when I announced that I wanted to be a songwriter, nobody went, oh, wait a minute, you got to get a real job, you know.
Yeah.
I was encouraged, you know, to go make up stuff, you know. And my sister's a clothing designer in San Francisco, and my brother and his wife, Billy, make Billy Bees, which are these tremendously cool, you know, pieces of art that you wear.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a lot of, you know, and I took it for granted for many years. And now that I teach a lot of workshops and I do a lot of teaching to people, not just songwriters, but people of all different walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm so passionate about is I'm really good at helping people find out that they too have access to this creative flow. I mean, you're born, it's a birthright.
And yeah.
It's so easily stamped out of us at a young age by well-meaning, rule-making adults, or sometimes ridicule by our peers, that you have to resurrect your own pilot light and the ability to relight it. And
Absolutely.
It goes out, and you got to relight it. You know, you got to get back into that connection with our creative gift that we're all given.
Oh, I know. It's about inspiring that fire inside, isn't it?
It is, and also remembering that even if you're feeling really depleted, that it's just like eating lunch, you know, that wears off, and then it's time to cook something else and eat dinner, you know. So you have to understand it's cultivation of a relationship. It's not just, oh, she's so talented and she's so creative and she just does all this stuff and it just happens so easily for her.
Yeah, exactly.
It's never like that. It's a cultivation, and the skill of staying connected to your inner creative genius is a real accessible opportunity that everybody has.
When did you know? When was there a pivotal moment for you, Beth, when you realized and you were starting to write music, play music, that, wow, I could actually make a living doing this?
Well, you know, it was back in that day, I could.
Expenses and, were low.
I came of age at a time when people that were talented songwriters got publishing deals. That's very much changed, and that's a whole other conversation. But I do remember being amazed that I could go and, you know, like somebody called me up and they'd heard me singing in church or something or some school thing, and they said, would you sing at my wedding? Yeah. And I remember being like 16 or so and going, oh, sure, thinking, wow, how that's really going to be fun. And then they paid me, and I was blown away. I didn't even think I was going to, I didn't even think about it getting paid. And then pretty soon I was just doing 5 weddings a week, you know, and I started to, so much of the stuff that happened to me early on just sort of happened very naturally and unfolded without me trying. Mm-hmm. So I got this sort of false sense of, oh, this is easy, you know, and I sort of stumbled into making my first record in Muscle Shoals with Barry Beckett producing and all the great Muscle Shoals guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and looking back on it, I can see, well, the reason that they were interested is because I showed talent and I had, you know, some songs that showed that I was maybe someone that could do this. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I thought I was just getting away with murder. You know, I thought, well, any minute they're going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. But hey, as long as it works. So, but then there was also this kind of overlay within me of almost a sense of entitlement. Like, well, of course, everything I do is great because my mom said that. you know, and I'd never had anybody actually challenge me to be better or to, hey, you know, you should really rewrite that song and make it better. And so when my first album came out on Capitol Records in 1979, the universe planned it perfectly, you know, as it rolled out, and I was completely convinced that the next thing was I'd have a big hit, and then I'd be touring, and then I'd have to get a manager, and everything would be perfect. And then nothing happened. It was like it came out, and I got some reviews that said things like, too bad she didn't put this out 5 years ago, because this is really quite nice, you know, like Carole King. Only what was happening is that Disco Duck was all over the airwaves and Donna Summer, and suddenly everything went disco. Mm. And singer-songwriter-sensitive music kind of went bye-bye for a while, right as I came out the gate. So, I went and licked my wounds for 3 or 4 years and just went back home, had a baby, and decided, I'm not really a singer-songwriter. I must not have what it takes, which is such a bad conclusion.
Oh,
and I shut myself down. And, you know, when I'm teaching songwriters that or people that are trying to recreate how to be creative, I'm like, I know exactly where you're at. You're in this abyss of not believing in yourself. And I know that feeling. And it's just that you just have to start doing it again, and it regrows. Mm-hmm. It really does. Mm-hmm. It comes back, and you know. But it just took me a couple of years. But I'd say, you know, some of the biggest developments for me as a songwriter were the years that I didn't write, because during that time I was busy just being in my life and getting experiences, so that when I did go back to writing, I had a little bit more depth about what I had to say.
Yeah, You shared something earlier, and I think it is tragic, and I agree with you. One of the things that has kept me drawn to your music is I think you're a master storyteller. I remember having a similar conversation with a friend of this radio show and a fellow Hoosier, a Carrie newcomer, who I see as a gifted storyteller. And it does seem like, I'm hoping that makes a resurgence now, because I'd hate to think we're living in a Bieber world. with so much superficiality, and the lyrics don't count, because back in the day, like we talked about, James Taylor, Carole King, Beth Nielsen Chapman, it's the lyrics that are powerful, and that's what I have so appreciated about your work. I want to skip ahead a little bit, because I want to go to one of the songs that I want to play, and I just love this song, and there is a powerful story behind this. And that was when your first husband, Ernest, died of cancer. I believe it was in 1994.
Yeah, that's right.
As an interfaith minister, part of my past was working with hospice, and so I was always with a lot of people who went through those dark shadows of the soul, if you will. And first of all, what was that like for you? And I believe one of the things that helped you deal with your grief was your songwriting, and then you wrote the song Sand and Water.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the moment, you know, that I started playing that guitar to survive through the late 60s onward, it was a refuge for me. With the exception of the few years after my record came out, I put the guitar in the closet and I decided to turn my back on it because it was like it wasn't working. But when I did pull that back into my life, obviously, anytime I have given it a chance, that creative flow has definitely shown up. And going through the loss of my husband was the most incredible, difficult thing I could have ever imagined. And I remember writing half of the songs that ended up on the Sand and Water album. I had started about a year and a half before he was diagnosed. And I didn't even know what I was writing them about. There's a song on that album called Seven Shades of Blue, which I remember playing it for him way before we knew we had cancer on the horizon. And he loved that song, and he would say, "You gotta finish that song. I gotta finish it. It's like your Bob Dylan song. It's my favorite thing you've ever done. What's it about?" I'm like, "I don't know," but you know, that's happened to me many times in my life where I've started writing things before the actual events happened.
Mm-hmm.
And even writing "Sand and Water," which I wrote about a month after Ernest died, I sat down and it came through very quickly, but it was like the melody came through, and then the sound of the words came through. Like I was writing down nonsense syllables, but the vowels were there.
Yeah,
that matched up with the final lines.
Yeah.
So it was almost as if that song was rising up through the sand, and I couldn't quite make it out, but I was just following the shape of it.
Mm.
And I write a lot of songs that way, from a very sort of intuitive place. And you know, intuition is one of the things that's kind of scary to people because we want to, you know, our brains want to name everything and they want to know everything and get everything organized and figure out where it belongs. And creativity is the antithesis of that. And I know that you have to be a good editor and a good analyzer, and you have to be able to get the nuts and bolts and the craft of writing really, you know, well established in order to be a very accomplished songwriter. But if you don't have the front end of that, which is this sort of mushy, I don't even know what, I don't know what's happening. You know, I don't know, something's coming through me. If you can get comfortable not knowing what you're doing, if you can get comfortable in the space of like it hasn't happened yet, but it could happen any second, but you're waiting for it. That's what I work with people on the most, because God knows they've been given enough rules and they've read all the books and they know all the ways to make the song better. But if you don't have the beginning of something that's strong enough that comes from that place of our deep emotional experience, then, you know, Nashville, if you'll pardon the expression, the way that they put that in Nashville is you can spend a lot of time polishing a turd, but a turd is still a turd. You know, it's like you can polish it, you can have it very well organized, but if you're not reaching somebody's heart.
Yeah.
So that process of being grief-stricken, unbeknownst to me, you know, now looking back, of course, I can talk about it very clearly, but in the moment that I was writing that song, I was in a moment of chaos and sort of surrendered sorrow of such a deep level that I just didn't even think I was doing anything. I remember writing it down and going, well, this doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And the first person I played it for was Rodney Crowell, who was coming over to my house. And he was like, I said, "Mom, I'm going to play the song. Maybe you can help me fix it." And I played him Sand and Water as it completely is right now. And he was like, "Wow." And I said, "Yeah, I know. It's not great." He goes, no, it's really good." And I'm like, no. He goes, no, it's really, let me tell you something. He goes, "You are a grieving widow woman and you don't know what you just wrote." And he goes, "Please don't touch that and leave it alone. And it'll take care of itself. It'll go out in the world. And 20 years from now, you're still going to be hearing back from people that found that song when they needed to hear it."
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened with it. And so when I do a little seminar and I'm playing my hits and whatever, I'll play my This Kiss hit, you know, and then I'll play Sand and Water and say, "Now, this is another kind of a hit."
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, it's like a soul hit. You know, it's one of those songs that as a songwriter, I feel so thankful
that anything I wrote out of all that pain has gone forward without me even ever anticipating that.
Yeah.
And has been helpful to other people.
Yeah, it's a very heartfelt song. It was also good enough for Elton John to perform it during his 97 world tour. One of the lyrics that really struck me, and I couldn't help but think of a few families I had worked with in the past. All alone I heal this heart of sorrow. All alone I raise this child. Flesh and bone, he's just bursting towards tomorrow. And his laughter fills my world. And where's your smile? You were speaking of your husband who had passed away. I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life with singer-songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman. We're going to go to that song right now, and after, we'll have more of the conversation. Here's Sand and Water.
Gone by.
Welcome back to the program. It is a joy to have Beth Nielsen Chapman joining us today. We're talking about, her music, her life. There's other topics I want to get to here shortly. Beth, one of the things that struck me about you, and I didn't really realize how often songs are used this way until Joshua Radin has been on the program a couple of times, because so many of his songs are actually in TV shows and movies. Well, yours are as well. And as a matter of fact, this song that we had just played, Sand and Water, I believe it was in one of the seasons of ER, which I used to watch all the time, and TV show Charmed. And and a lot of your songs have been in those kind of venues. As an artist, how does that happen? How do your songs make it into shows like that?
Well, all different ways. I mean, in the case of quite a few of the songs I had that were in TV shows around that time, there was a woman that worked through my publishing company, which was Alma Irving at that time, and her name was Marianne Good, and she just was fantastic at hearing a song and coupling it with the right spot in a TV show. And I mean, there's some fantastic, talented people who that's their art form. You know, they're so important to songwriters because we're just putting our little songs out there, you know, we just want to get back to the sound hole at our knee, as Joni Mitchell would put it, and go back in, you know, and get more of that stuff and bring it back out. And the amazing amount of talent and help that we need to get it to the next point is, to me, one of the things that's the most difficult about the time that we're in right now for young songwriters. If you don't already have a hit, you almost can't get a publishing deal because the bed of soil has been stripped dry for the creative community because of this paradigm that we're in right now, where there's a lot, you know, the thing is, just to put it in a nutshell, because I know it's a whole other conversation and we don't want to spend our time trying to figure it all out, it's too big, but the bottom line is, music has never generated more interest, it's never generated more money and more attention than it is right now. And the only thing that's changed is that those who have access to that flow are cordoning it off, and they're not replacing any of the energy from the money and the attention back into the soil, which is the songwriters and the creative people that wrote the thing in the first place. And just to keep it super general, you know, the public has been sort of brainwashed into kind of thinking, oh, music should be free, and, you know, like, I should turn on the radio and hear the song for free. And, you know, I've turned on the radio my whole life and heard the song for free in between the soap commercials, which is where people got to make a living. And that element, you know, it's been hijacked. And, you know, now to get a song in a TV show, you have to have a publishing dealer, you have to have support from someone, and they have to be able to make a living. They've got to be able to feed their family, too. So the whole infrastructure of being able to do this as a life's work has been severely undermined. And, you know, it's not just that Beyonce can't get paid. And frankly, it's not even about that. It's about those people that you don't know about, that you don't see. The Marianne Goods who got me that thing on, you know, got my song on that show that, you know, helped me be able to write more songs. So, you know, one of the things that I hope to see in the next 10 years, and I'm working in every way I can, is to heal that misinformation. And I think people out there, they love music so much. I mean, and I don't care if they pay for it themselves or not. I just don't want there to be this continuation of people gaining income that are not putting it back into the soil.
Yeah.
They're taking and taking and taking. And it's not just that it's free and everybody's enjoying free music. It's that people are benefiting. And I won't even go bother to be specific about who. I think we know who. But that's the end of my lecture on that. But I think that's important for me to say, because I am a person who's made my living as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And I'm among so many young, talented people, as talented or way more talented than I ever was, who literally can't do what I did because of the situation. So sorry for hijacking you onto that.
No. A lot of artists are talking about the same thing, and they need to be doing that. And by the way, your latest album came out last year, is called Uncovered, and that is where you are now singing all these songs that these other artists had hits with, whether it be This Kiss or Simple Things. I first heard that on Jim Brickman's album, and I had no idea till much later you wrote that song.
Yes, I loved the artist, Rebecca Lynn Howard, who sang that. At the time, I was just coming through breast cancer, and I wasn't quite up and running, and, you know, I would have loved to have sung that record myself, but Rebecca did a beautiful job and, you know, went to number one, so we can't complain about that. and Jim did a fantastic record with Daryl Brown. The three of us wrote that song together. And the whole record, Uncovered, has been so much fun to do because, you know, I'd always had my versions of these songs. And, you know, if you came to one of my shows, you'd always hear This Kiss or, you know, the song I wrote for Willie Nelson or Waylon Jennings or something. And I have a lot of fans going, yeah, you should put that on a record. And I thought, wow, you know, that'll be fun. And so I just thought it'd be really fun to do a whole record of songs where I took back my covers. Lost the title.
Yeah. I want to ask you, for you as a creative, I mean, the term we have actually trademarked here is social change artist, singers, songwriters, other people, visionaries, if you will, but using their creativity, because something the teacher Matthew Fox has often said is we all have that spark of creativity within us, and it helps us to think outside the box and to think differently, to come up with perhaps a solution to a problem that no one else is solving. As a creative yourself, as a storyteller, you write songs, you also perform them, but you've had other artists perform them. For you, what is most satisfying in the creative process?
Wow. You know, it's really hard to pinpoint that because all of those parts and pieces are really fun. But I have to say, my most fulfilling moment that I experience is when I've just finished a song and I feel really good about it, and I feel like it's whole, you know, and that sometimes can take years. I mean, I got a song now, my top lengthy song, my highest amount of years to finish the song is still ongoing, is 18 years. I'm actually still working on a song I started 18 years ago. But, you know, I scare people off when I say that. Most of them I finish much faster than that. But it's the feeling of, you know, there it is, and it's focused in, and I haven't walked out the door with it. It hasn't been beat up by the outside world. It hasn't been rejected. It hasn't been judged or anything, you know. And so I have this lovely honeymoon period while I'm just putting the finishing touches on it. And I think that's my favorite part. And I feel that way when I'm making a record as well, like I'm just getting it. Finally getting the mix right, and then I feel really excited, and then I have to go through this other part of the birth canal, which is very scary, where it goes out and it, you know, it enters into the air, and somebody slaps and it starts crying, and God knows what happens to it next, and then you just have to let it go.
Yeah.
It's like having a baby, you know, you just go, I'm going to do my best, baby, I'm going to try everything I can to protect you and support you, and then at some point you got to go off in the world and do what you're going to do. So
I want to have you take us inside the music on another song I want to cue up here soon. Actually, the CD I got was a gift from a friend of mine. I had brought a beautiful soul to Indianapolis several years ago, a Deepak Chopra here. And I've loved what he's been about. And this person went out to the Chopra Center and they were playing your music and they brought back, they felt like, maybe because I'm all about bringing love to life, they brought your album back to love. And I so loved all the songs on here. The one I want to go to right now is How We Love. And I'd like to find out the inspiration for some of those songs.
Oh, man. Well, Back to Love, you know, I had done a record called Prism, which was a double CD where I sang in 9 different languages. And it was a big labor of love for me, and it took 10 years to make, and it was really a big learning curve. It was a song about all different paths of faith and using my voice as kind of a common thread. And that came out in 2007. So in 2010, I put out Back to Love, which was basically just me returning to my love and life songs, you know, basic, not complicated, not too much, you know, that I had to know about. And in the process of writing those songs, How We Love actually is one of those songs that I was just stumped. I wrote everything except the third verse, and I was really stuck. And around 2009, when I was trying to get this thing finished, I woke up one morning and my ears were ringing really bad, and I ended up going to the doctor, freaking out because I couldn't hear pitch, and I was afraid something terrible would happen to my hearing. And they did an MRI, and they found that I had a brain tumor. And I was just, like, totally unprepared for that. And I remember thinking, I can't put that in my show. You know, like, I already talked about losing my husband and then going through breast cancer. And, like, I just can't fit another tragedy into my show. And I was, like, odd thing to think of. But what I had not really put together was, because they said, this is pressing against your left frontal lobe, and that's your language center. And have you had any trouble with words? And I was, like, all of a sudden, my ego sort of reached past my fear and said, well, actually, yes, I've had a really hard time writing the third verse of this song. And would that have been, because of this brain tumor? And they said, oh, absolutely, because you should be having trouble talking. And I'm like, really? And I was so relieved. I was like, that's fantastic. And they were like, what? We just told you you had a brain tumor. But the good news is it was benign, and they got it in time. And it had nothing to do with why my ears were ringing. I think that was just angels showing up in my head, sounding an alarm.
Yeah.
But I ended up waking up from that surgery, and the entire third verse of How We Love was just bouncing around in my head, perfectly written, ready to be written down. And my feeling was, you know, that creativity is this thing that's just there. And it would have, you know, I had started losing hope that I was maybe still creative because I couldn't get this thing written. And it was such a relief to me to know that it was just a technical barrier, you know, to getting that done. And so How We Love is one of my favorite songs on the Back to Love album, because it reconnected me with my prior belief, which is that creativity is like oxygen, and, you know, we just can breathe it in, and some of us have more lung capacity than others, but you can work on that part.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song off a very beautiful album, another great album from Beth Nielsen Chapman. The album is Back to Love. The song that we're going to go to right now is How to Love, and then we'll have more conversation.
Life has taught me this. Every day is new, and if anything is true, all that matters when we're through is how we love. Faced with what we lack, some things fall apart. But from the ashes, new dreams start. All that matters to the heart is how we love. How we love. How we love. From the smallest act of kindness, in a word, a smile, a touch. In spite of our mistakes, chances come again. If we lose or if we win, all that matters in the end is how we love.
Thank you.
Sometimes we forget, trying to be so strong in this world of right and wrong. All that matters when we're gone. All that mattered all along. All we have that carries on is how.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. Today we're bringing love to life with someone who knows a little bit about love, I believe. Beth Nielsen Chapman. She's a master storyteller, singer, songwriter. Beth, I want to talk about something else that you're passionate about, and I believe you have something coming up, I think, in Nashville in July. But you do a lot of coaching and songwriting teaching, and I love that. You're helping people discover their own voice, and I think that is so important these days to do.
It's really been a passion of mine, you know, because I've gone through those periods of time where I lost faith in my ability to be a writer and then refound it and found out that it never was gone, you know, that if the door is locked, it's usually locked from the inside. And mm-hmm. I've got so many ways that I've developed over the years to help people feel that flow. And there's nothing more exciting to me than seeing somebody's pilot light go back on, you know, that's been snuffed out by their own fear or their own lack of confidence or, you know, and people come that are really serious songwriters, and other people come that are, you know, maybe just went through a divorce and just want to kick themselves into some kind of new thing, or, you know, there's all different reasons to get inspired. And, I'm teaching in July 9th through 11th in Nashville. And, I've been doing these workshops with Lydia Hutchinson, who, is the founder of a wonderful magazine that used to be out called The Performing Songwriter. Mm-hmm. And she's got a website, performingsongwriter.com, and she does workshops with a lot of different writers, and she's cultivated this wonderful team. And when you do a workshop with this particular setup, I mean, there's so much attention to detail, and I come in and teach, and then there's all these other great activities. You just really get to be immersed in the writing world, and also in Nashville, you know, which is so much fun. And and it's really been a great thing for me to be involved in. And I'm also teaching at Omega this summer up in upstate New York in Rhinebeck.
Yeah, what a beautiful place.
With the wonderful David Wilcox. I don't know if you've ever interviewed him, but he's wonderful. He's just a genius.
And what a beautiful place to do that kind of work out there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
How would you, by the way, speaking of Omega, and Elizabeth Lerner has been on the program, one of the co-founders there, what a beautiful soul she is. How would you now describe your spirituality? What is that like for you?
Well, it's never really changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was raised in a Catholic family, mm-hmm. and I remember getting put in the hallway in the first grade because I was struggling with the whole idea that God would put a dark mark on my soul and I'd have to have somebody else wash it off before I'd be okay.
Yeah.
And I remember asking those tough questions, and Sister Mary something or other be like, Miss Nielsen, you're sitting in the hall again today. And I love my Catholic roots, and I love many of the aspects of so many paths of sacred devotion. I feel as comfortable walking into a Hindu temple as I do walking into a Buddhist shrine, walking into the woods, walking into a Catholic church, walking into a Baptist church. And I know that there are some religious paths of faith that are, this is the only way, you know. And I think I just never felt that there could only just be one way. I just never have my entire life. I resonate with Mary. I feel a kinship with Jesus. I also feel that with Buddha. And, you know, you could have any number of people from any one of those directions come at me and say, well, then you don't stand for anything. But I feel like
the concept of the source of all of this is so much broader than one of the colors or one of the flippers. And my favorite, probably one of my favorite hymns of all time is actually a Christian hymn that says, "Further along we'll understand why."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know all the answers of why. I just defer to the teacher of spiritual knowledge, you know.
Yeah.
And I live in a world where when my husband Ernest was dying of cancer, he sent out a letter to everybody that had meant anything to him in his life. And he said, basically, "I'm dying, and I'd love to hear from you what you think happens after death, because I'm struggling."
Mm-hmm.
And he got letters back from every walk of faith, all these different friends of ours through his life. And his favorite letter was from a professor of philosophy that was one of his good friends when he was in college, who was an atheist, mm-hmm. and still was an atheist. And mm-hmm. he wrote back and said, "You know, Chapman, I nothing's changed. I still believe what I've always believed, which is that you die, you're dead, there's nothing. But for some reason today, I sent up for you the prayers of an atheist."
Mm.
Whatever that's worth.
Yeah.
Probably nothing, you know. And I remember my husband looking up from that letter saying, "You know what? The prayers of an atheist might be one of the most powerful prayers because it has to travel the farthest."
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I'm just, you know, to me, it's like there's so much mystery and phenomenal stuff. Like you can go on YouTube and see these plates where somebody shakes salt onto these flat plates, and they put certain frequencies into them,
mm-hmm.
and they organize, the salt organizes itself into geometric shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, if you're a very scientific person and you're not easily swayed into any religious model, that's, to me, that's God showing up for you, going, "You know what, dude, I'm here, okay?"
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's in every aspect of our existence. And it take, to me, it's many, many forms and many, many faces of that same source.
I
felt that way since I was 5, really.
I so believe that. As a matter of fact, I think I describe my faith now. I borrowed a line from Ziggy Marley, and that's, "Love is my religion." So
there you go. Yeah,
makes
there
a lot of sense. By the way, we talk a lot on this program about loving ourselves, one another, and the earth, and I've been told that you have a passion for the environment.
Absolutely. I'm telling you what. Going through chemotherapy will definitely give you a quick education in chemicals to avoid.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So after I came through that in the year 2000, I had become good friends with Olivia Newton-John, mm-hmm. who is one of my heroes, and she's also a breast cancer survivor. And one of her dear friends and her husband had started an organization many years ago because they lost their young child to an environmentally caused form of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Healthy Child, Healthy World. And I became a member of the board of directors for several years, and I learned so much about chemicals that just we're exposed to on a regular basis. And it's a wonderful organization because they give the information to parents, and then they can make their advised decisions. So if you just go to healthychild.org, you can find out things you do not want to put in your body or in your house or on your fingers, and other options of things that you can use. And so I mentioned David Wilcox earlier. He's one of my dearest friends and an amazing songwriter. He's fearless. So he comes into my studio one day, and we're going to write a song. And I said, "David, I want to write a children's horror song about chemical additives, but I want to make it fun and entertaining, kind of like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious."
Yes.
So we wrote this song called "Right Downstream," and I can email it to you. It's really a very fun-loving song with all these chemical names. And we had, like, the head doctors at Cedars-Sinai, you know, and Mount Sinai Hospital in New York helping us with, you know, what does this do and how does it affect the body. And we've got it all in the song. It's all packed in there. And it's actually up on the Huffington Post as well.
Oh, wonderful.
If you Google Huffington Post and my name, you can see, you can download it for free because we just gave it to the world.
Okay, great.
And it's a fun song that talks about all these chemicals and what they do. And, you know, and basically the chorus says, you know, and we're all living right downstream.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we only got one ball that we're floating around on here so far. So I'm very passionate about that. And
there's another incredible person that I work with that started this thing called the Plastic Pollutants Coalition, and, you know, talking about that we have got to stop the use of throwaway plastic, and it's just, there's so much to address, you know, mm-hmm. and it, as you know, it just gets more intense every year. Yeah. But I do feel that there has been a shift. People are becoming more aware of what, you know, what we're dealing with here, mm-hmm. and I mean, I'm thinking of, I just had a grandbaby, you know, he's almost two, and now I have a real vested interest in making
Absolutely.
Sure I do everything I can, because he's going to be an adult dealing with all this stuff, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. My granddaughter just turned one a couple days ago, and just being around her and my daughter and the family and such, it reminded me of really what's most important in life. I think the older I get, and I've gone through a few things like a lot of people have, just as you have, and I want it to take me as we wind down our conversation. It was so hard to pick the body of work that you've done, but it is one of my favorite songs because it reminds me to continue to be childlike the older I get, and that's the song Simple Things.
Yes.
Where did that inspiration come from you when you penned that?
Well, I wrote that with Jim Brickman and Daryl Brown, uh-huh. who produced the record. Daryl and Jim were working on a record together, and they, you know, Daryl and I were friends, and he called me up and said, "You're going to write a song with us today." And I was literally on the last day of, you know, coming out of 6 months of treatment for breast cancer. I was a shell of myself. I was very nervous, and I said, "Okay, but I may not be able to write. I'm not sure. I'm just my synapses are not firing yet, you know." And the brain is very heavily affected by the drugs for chemo that I was on. But they came over, and they were very gentle. And by the end of the day, we had that song, and I was so excited to feel myself reconnecting. In my mind, if I felt my brain working, I came up with a lot of those lines. I felt like, oh my God, I'm going to be able to do this again. Mm-hmm. And I was just like tearing up by the end of that day because, you know, it felt like something that could be taken away from me. And I knew I would be okay and I'd live, but I wanted to live and be as good of a songwriter as I felt like I had been. And I just wasn't sure that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And that song was like, I got it. I'm back. It was very exciting, and you know, it inspired me to keep going. And sometimes you just need that. You got to take that little risk and get past the fear of, oh my God, what if I do this and then I find out I can't do it?
Yeah,
that's scarier to people than anything. But there's nothing more enlivening mm-hmm. than going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get it the first time, you just do it again.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And Beth, it comes back.
It does.
I can guarantee you.
It does. Beth, you've been very gracious with your time. I want to thank you so much for the songs
well,
that you,
you
write, how it inspires us. And for more information, our listeners can visit the website, BethNielsenChapman.com. Blessings
That's
to you.
That's right.
Thanks,
thank
Beth.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate you talking to me.
Hey, Beth Nielsen Chapman.
Out of all the moments that we leave
Today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me, and please get the word out to all your friends to visit this website and all the other interviews I've had and future podcasts that we're going to have too. It's a joy of my life to be able to provide this for all of you. I want to thank my engineer Thomas Gismondi and production coordinator Angel Richardson for making this possible. I'm Richard Brendan, and yes, you've been listening to Dying to Live.